Всім добрий вечір.
On behalf of the brave. On behalf of every father and every mother. Wings for freedom. On behalf of our warriors. And paves the way for a new history.
Of course, today is a very notable day in Ukraine's calendar, and it is with thanks that Ukraine's allies remember its defenders today, whilst Ukraine mourns her fallen across the sea in a garden of Ukrainian flowers, fallen or wounded in the cause of the free and the freedom of the world beyond Ukraine's borders. The words of Lawrence Binion from 1914 still resonate today, of course, paraphrased or in their original form in 2023. So we're going to be privileged today to be joined by a range of speakers. The theme is going to be defense. Privileged to be joined right now by John Ridge, who is going to be talking about missile defense, and CJ as well, who is going to be able to add his experience to this discussion. Later on, we're going to be joined from Dnipro by Vassil, who is going to give an insight into how defense of his city and the Ukrainians he knows in his life has changed throughout the course of from the 24th of February to today, and what he sees as the most immediate needs to protect the Ukrainians he knows in his life. So welcome up to the panel, John and CJ.
Hello, hello.
Pleasure to be here.
Gentlemen, I'll give you a choice. Where would you like to begin? John, you were first up, so I'm going to turn to you. Missile defense, air defense, what topics are most germane, in your opinion, on this particular day?
Right. So the two major items, and unfortunately there's not really very many specifics published as of yet about what this will entail, but the two major items are: there has apparently been some sort of agreement reached between the United States and Ukraine, as referenced by President Zelensky about a week ago now, I believe, that there will be some sort of localized production of a American air defense asset in Ukraine, asset or assets. It isn't exactly clear what it is. It could be a range of things. It could be as simple as Stingers, or it could be something all the way up to producing interceptors for Patriot. There's really a fairly wide range of possibilities there. But that's a promising development for the future, no matter what it is. Obviously, some of the higher end stuff might be ideal longer term, but either way, a distinctly positive development. There was also discussion, I believe, with France that there had some sort of agreement had been reached, again, regarding the localization of production of certain air defense capabilities within Ukraine. Unfortunately, no details were released. There's absolutely no information about what that specifically is or what that would end up entailing. That was part of a broader French package of agreements to localize mainly production of spare parts for various existing equipment, such as the Caesars and other assets that they're already operating, as well as the co-development of various unmanned aerial systems, UAS. Really the most notable item in there besides that was they are now looking into licensing production of VAB, which is a French armored personnel carrier. So that would presumably complement their existing efforts to establish licensed production of the Fuchs, which is a German APC designed by Rheinmetall, a plan for which is currently being built somewhere in Western Ukraine.
What kind of timescale are we looking at here, Joe? Ukraine has been, over the last week, there's been a bit of news about Ukraine independently setting up these manufacturing capabilities for itself. What kind of timescale would you put on this?
So in terms of setting up a production line from scratch, I think what we're more likely to see is maybe an approach similar to what they're doing with the Fuchs, where it's a phased approach to setting up production. The first phase, they're really just establishing capacity to perform maintenance, servicing, repairs, as well as refurb and overhaul work on vehicles being provided from other sources. And then from there, they're going to evolve that into an actual production line that can produce them essentially from scratch. In terms of a timeline for setting up that sort of capacity, we'd probably be looking at a minimum 12 months, probably longer, 16 months more likely, depending on the specifics and, you know, how exactly they want to approach it, how much money is being put into the program, and what the available resources are.
Okay. Could I briefly ask you about air defense in terms of the Ukrainian Air Force? We've seen an increase in Russian drone activity throughout this war, along with Ukraine's ingenuity in its own adaptation to drone warfare. What help do you think the West can provide most immediately to bolster Ukraine's air force and protect the lives of its pilots?
Well, there's already a large number of systems on order, additional NASAMS batteries, IRST SLMs. There has been discussions that there is potentially a sale of multiple Patriot batteries has been made to Ukraine. There's not good confirmation of that in public sources yet, but there's some reasonably strong indicators that that has occurred. You know, keeping those delivery timelines on track for all of those systems is probably the most important thing going into this fall and winter, particularly if there is a legitimate threat that the Russians have stockpiled stand-up munitions, be it cruise missiles or one-way attack UAVs, to execute some sort of strike campaign, you know, be it against infrastructure, critical infrastructure, as it was last winter, or perhaps a different target set this time around. Keeping those delivery timelines on track is going to be the crucial thing. There's already been, I guess, some major progress in terms of sustainment of Ukraine's existing Soviet legacy air defense assets. Namely, the Bulgarians have opened up their inventory of 5V55 interceptors for S-300P, which is currently represents obviously the bulk of Ukraine's medium to long range air defense capabilities, given that they only have two Patriot batteries and one SAMP-T battery. The Bulgarians, in my understanding, have an anomalously large inventory of 5V55s for reasons that I'm not aware of. They should be able to provide a rather substantial volume of those interceptors to Ukraine and be able to, you know, keep sustaining their current capabilities for quite a decent bit of time. Those interceptors will require refurb work, but that's all in scope. Ukraine is perfectly capable of servicing and refurbing those interceptors as needed.
Okay, thank you, John. Just while we bring a few other people up, I'm going to turn to the wonderful CJ. It's great to see you here, CJ. As Ukraine liberates its territory, it's got to defend newly won ground. Could you give us an idea of what is involved in holding on, defending newly liberated Ukrainian soil?
Well, there is a lot of good news and bad news in this question, which is such an important one. As we can sort of see in multiple axes, especially in the south, of course, Ukraine is slowly but surely moving. However, there is the phenomenon which is happening, of course, of the Russian counterattack. We know it's happening, of course, via their own Russian videos and Russian FPVs, and typically this is how we know best that Ukraine has actually made progress, since, of course, they are not very public with exactly what trenches they've taken or not taken, but that's how we get our data, and it's pretty good because it's pretty easy to geolocate. It's moving so slowly, and so one of the things that's interesting, of course, is a lot of times you'll see fighting over a trench, but, you know, the trench can be defended in two directions, so that is one of the slight benefits of Russia digging in so much, is that as Ukraine takes a trench system, they can then use that same system to defend. Now, obviously, the drawback is the Russians probably know exactly where it is, and, you know, we can debate exactly how good the Russians are at building trenches, but that's neither here nor there. So since there's so many counterattacks coming after Ukraine takes a single position, you know, this is known information, and this, of course, happens both ways. So we're seeing different loadouts of weapons, you know, a lot of anti-tank missiles, a lot of ammunition covering the front, because this is known that as soon as Ukraine takes a position, they're probably going to come under a counterattack. And it's not necessarily a good or bad thing, right? I think a lot of people, as the counteroffensive goes into the fall here, assumed that it would be over, and that has not happened yet. There has been no culmination or clear transition, and that could be a good thing. if Ukraine is continuing to push and they continue to receive ammo and all the support they need. And it could be a bad thing if they've overextended themselves. But I haven't seen anything to suggest that the positions they've taken and the casualties they've taken, which are, of course, extremely high, are going to set them up for failure through the winter. If Russia does manage to accumulate enough forces for a strike, an offensive action in a major way, the situation will be quite different, right? The situation will include perhaps TACMs by then, perhaps enough Abrams by then, and perhaps who knows what else. So this is the thing. There are a lot of casualties being taken by Ukraine, but the sort of culmination point, which will come and isn't inherently a bad word, might come under a different set of circumstances. And I think that's why Ukraine is still pushing forward right now, because they know, despite the casualties, that, you know, more aid is coming, more support is coming, more trained brigades are still being worked on. And so the situation when they do transition will hopefully be quite different than this. But yeah, I know people are wanting to see liberations every day, and it's okay that it's not happening. But if you look at all the strikes and the massive amounts of damage Russia's taking into the rear, that's a really good sign that they have not quite culminated yet. But who knows when.
CJ, what prioritization of targets should Ukraine look for with this limited number of ATACMS that it's being given?
Well, the first thing you would need to know is what's even on the table. I think a lot of people are hoping that, you know, Ukraine will get some sort of magical weapon that will allow them to, for example, take out the Kerch Bridge. And I think it's pretty clear to everyone right now that they could have done that a while ago, at least in terms of capability. I mean, they've had, you know, multiple hundreds of storm shadows and so on and so forth. But for whatever reason, it's not politically on the table right now. So that goes for a lot of different targets. And I would not be so presumptuous to say what I think they should target. But as we've seen with the security around the Russian airfields, that's probably a good first place to look. And I think everyone knows that, because even if they are putting tires or some limited shelters, it's not going to be enough to stop these long-range missiles, especially as we saw earlier today. Yeah, allegedly, Ukraine was able to get some very small long-range drones into Sochi and perhaps take out some helicopters. So that kind of tells you the state of the Russian aviation defenses. So I think we'll probably see some of that first. And of course, fuel, a lot of interesting long-range fuel strikes Ukraine has conducted recently now inside of Russia. I think there's really, it's a target-rich environment, as people like to say. But it also depends on a couple other things, like, are they going to get more conventional artillery ammo, right? If they're not going to get as much as they need, they might consider doing what they did last summer, really focusing on the ammunition depots. You know, if they're not going to get as many armored vehicles as they might like, they might focus on maintenance of Russian armored vehicles, you know? So there's a billion factors that play into it, but it's better for them to be deciding between the options than not having the capability at all, of course.
Thanks, CJ. In terms of the type of ATACMS that has been announced, are you content with that initial announcement? What extra would you like to see?
Well, I would defer to John, because, you know, he and or Colby, of course, because they worked much more on what's actually available. I could maybe suggest how these things should be used, but they would know best in terms of what's on the table and what's not.
Thanks, CJ. Over to you, Joel.
Thank you, Jonathan. So based upon, well, obviously, I should preface this by saying there hasn't been a formal announcement from the White House that ATACMS will be provided to Ukraine. The reporting based upon, you know, various leaked sources in the White House, DOD and State Department, has been that Ukraine is likely going to receive the M39A1 ATACMS with a submunition payload, about 300 or so APAM bomblets. I would not be surprised if they get a handful of the unitary, but given their specific operational needs, as well as the nature of current U.S. ATACMS inventory, there being a large quantity of expired M39A1s, the bulk will likely be those with cluster munition payloads.
Colby, you are hot off your epic ATACMS thread and the very remarkable Tochi talks that you did, and I know you did another recent podcast Forgive me, I've forgotten the name, but I know it's pretty popular. What's your take on the types of munitions that Ukraine needs most immediately?
Thanks. Yeah, the other one was geopolitics to Canada with Dmitry Perorovich. John's got it exactly right. I don't have much to add. I stress that we have to be careful about what we say. It's not an announcement, to be clear. It's leaked reporting in the media. President, Department of Defense, nobody has stated publicly that Ukraine is going to get ATACMS at all. Certainly not stated publicly which specific variants or how many of each missile they would get. So we're still dealing with a fair bit of uncertainty. But as far as what Ukraine needs the most, certainly the submunition payload of the M74 anti-personnel, anti-material cluster munitions is something that would be very beneficial for Ukraine and provide it with a unique capability that they don't have and couldn't get from any other weapon system that could be conceivably provided. So that's definitely what they would be most interested in getting. The unitary warheads have a role as well for certain targets, but getting the M39A1s with those cluster munitions is what they definitely need the most to go after distributed area targets at very long range. So hopefully they get a good number of those, but we really don't know with any degree of certainty which will be sent, how many, and when they might appear in theater as well.
I recently said, Colby, that there's an advantage to the speed at which ATACMS can strike a target in comparison to cruise missiles such as Storm Shadow, Scout PG. Could you give our audience, those who haven't read your thread, which I've just posted to the Nest, an idea of why this is possible with the ATACMS system?
Yeah, well, I mean, it flies roughly three times as fast as a Storm Shadow or a Scout PG, so that's a significant difference when we're talking about trying to successfully engage a time-sensitive target, something that's mobile and can relocate on short notice and, you know, may not be in its current location for very long. So there's going to be limitations in Ukrainian ISR as well in identifying those targets, but I think Ukrainians have demonstrated that they can be pretty quick and nimble, at least with Gimblers. And yeah, there are challenges the further you go out, but it does offer them the ability to strike Russian targets much, much quicker than that they're able to currently by launching these air-launched cruise missiles that have to be carried by fighter jets, which are based further back in Western Ukraine. So just the timeline for engaging these targets is definitely shorter than it is with their current available munitions.
Thanks, Colby. In terms of the ground view, CJ, how important, what kind of role do you see from the cover at the infantry perspective, ATACMS playing? What kind of importance does this have in terms of defending liberated ground?
So really, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, there's been a large increase in the number of Russian air-to-ground munitions, specifically in a sort of a tactical sense. What other people may consider CAS or close air support, not really quite the same, of course, in Soviet doctrine or what's going on here, but functionally it looks a lot similar. You see, you know, pretty massive unguided and unguided bombs being dropped on Ukrainian trenches, Ukrainian positions, Ukrainian trains. And this is the type of thing that is going to slow down the offensive. And so what ATACMS will do, you know, the average Ukrainian infantry soldier may not directly see, you know, the shot or the missile, but what they will see is over time, you know, if these things are used to hit FARPs, for example, or, you know, forward army refueling points, that a lot of the helicopters, at least on the Russian side, use pretty close to the front, actually. And Russia Today and Russia TV will often post from these FARP sites, and not really obscure enough data, and they're occasionally hit. But things like that, taking out these sort of logistical bases that make the aviation go smoothly for Russia, it would put a huge chink in that. And as we've all seen from the months and months of watching the counteroffensive, if the Russian air component is degraded, even if it's just the helicopters, that would go quite a long way towards what's going on in the front. It would really give those Ukrainian infantrymen who, even if they entered the battle with very little training, they're very much so veterans at this point and very well trained, gives them a more fighting fair chance to keep pushing forward. So, I think everyone's always looking for a weapon or saying, some sort of weapon isn't a perfect fit. It doesn't really matter. Anything that has a significant capability is going to give Ukraine an edge to win the day, even if they don't use it in the ways that we might think or see or imagine at this time.
Thank you, CJ. John.
Thank you, Jonathan. The other thing I would add is that ATACMS really fits into this larger picture of sustaining the Ukrainian war effort on the long term, 12, 24 months from now. ATACMS in and of itself is not really a sustainable munition in the sense that the production volume for it is fairly low. We're probably talking maybe 10 missiles a month currently from Lockheed. Most of the capacity for this foreseeable future is booked out for foreign military sales, FMS orders with foreign customers. The production line will likely shrink, or rather its capacity will likely shrink as it shares common floor space with the Precision Strike Missile PrSM production line. So Lockheed will be converting portions of the ATACMS line to produce PrSMs as the months and years go by. What it does do is it helps bridge that gap. We've now seen the France, and I presume the UK will make a similar announcement to this sometime in the near future, that Storm Shadow, Scalp EG, and presumably Storm Shadow deliveries as well will be coming to an end sometime probably later this year. That's going to leave a gap that will need to be filled. That's one of the critical capabilities that Taurus brings to the table. It will help fill that gap until more sustainable long-term solutions can be operationalized. The main one being SLAM ER, Naval Strike Missile, potential air launch adaptation for that is another option. But really what ATACMS does is in some sense buy time. While the M39A1 provides a unique capability in and of itself that nothing else can provide, it, in addition to that, helps kind of buy time to fill that gap until we can better position ourselves to enable Ukraine's war effort to be sustained over the coming years.
Thank you, John. It's, of course, a great privilege to have and to be joined by Vasyl from Dnipro, who has spent this entire war living in Ukraine, living in Dnipro, and has experienced firsthand the issues regarding the defense of his nation, defense of the lives of the people of his city. Vasyl, welcome back to Tochny.
Jonathan, hello. How are you? Hear me? Everything okay?
Yeah, you're fine. You're fine. Vasyl, how has the defense of Dnipro changed for its citizens since the 24th of February, 2022?
Jonathan, I want to say that I think it's changed, critical changed, because at the start of this whole invasion, everyone haven't feel safety because it was a total horror. That is why it's very complicated to compare that situation and now. Now you feel more safety because you understand that our warriors, our soldiers, our heroes stand strong, and you understand that nothing in one moment can't change. That's why you feel more safety. We still have problems with these drones, Russian Shahed, also with Russian rockets, which sometimes can can come to everybody's house, everybody's flat, because Russians hit not in military targets, they hit everything, everyone which can, they can hit. That is why you can't totally feel safety when air alerts, when you know, when you hear some explosions, especially it's most horror to my children, because I am not afraid, but I'm afraid of the security of my children.
Vassil, the concept of defense for you, this I imagine, in amongst this sphere for you that you spoke of, this is happening in your city, and its citizens are being defended in different ways. They're being defended by its warriors preventing Russian occupation of Dnipro by holding the line and fighting and liberating territory to the south and to the east. It's also happening in terms of the air defense of Dnipro itself. Could you give people like me an idea of how these two combine? What is the most what you see as the thing which is a daily reminder for the people of your city?
Thanks, Jonathan, for a question. First of all, I want to say that in Dnipro, you don't feel such not a problem, such you feel more safety in understanding on about ground defense, something like that. We have patrols in Dnipro, we have police, police is working, and you don't feel any dangerous in this way. But in air defense, in air, you feel it more, because when you hear explosion, and some explosions are very near, it's not very good to feel, I say it. It's for me, because when maybe it was not maybe it was 14th of January this year, when a rocket hit apartment house in Dnipro, and then it was killed near 50 people, and 30 people haven't found yet, but I think they may be killed too. And after this strategy, when you hear your own explosions, it's very terrible feelings.
Thank you, Vassil. The Shahids you get warning from what I understand, you don't from the S-300, the ones that hit that apartment that you just referenced.
It was HAR-22 rocket.
I see.
Shahids not make so many casualties, so many destroyed houses and other objects. They don't have so many explosion power. Yeah, and most of them destroyed by our air defense. Sometimes you even heard the shots.
Could you give people like me an idea of what it's like to when you hear the air raid alarm and there are Shahids inbound on Dnipro, and you've no idea where they're going to hit, but you know that they pose an immediate threat to somebody's life. What happens then?
It's not a very good feeling. I suppose nobody to feel something like that. But I want to clarify that Shahids, it's maybe strange to hear, but Shahids isn't so danger, not so dangerous, it's not make so horror for people. Rockets, it's a big problem because can't make so, as I said before.
Thank you, Basil. On Defenders Day, I have two questions for you. How did the Ukrainians in your life mark Defenders Day today?
I want, first of all, say that we have little changes in the situation because before we have Defenders Day on 14th of October, not the 1st of October. It's changed because we are going to Gregorian calendar from Julian calendar. And also today is it's Pokrova, it's Ukrainian big Christian holiday, and it's also a holiday, it's also a Cossack day today. In this Defenders Day on 9 o'clock a.m. everyone have to stop, and it was a minute, silent minute today. Also, many people go to stands with our warriors, with flowers, and officials make the same. Zaluzhny make a video. I think you can be able to see Zelensky about today's day. I today not go and put flowers. I was with my children and explain them that we have to pray for our soldiers, for our soldiers, warriors, and explain them what is meaning of silent minute and why we have to be silent. And what it's very difficult to explain. My daughter is 3 years old, and she asked me, what does it mean, heroes dying? What is it? And it's very complicated to explain the meaning of these words.
I think that some parents can relate to that, Vassil. In my small part of the world, the 11th of November is Remembrance Day, and we have Remembrance Sunday, and we struggle to keep our kids quiet during that minute silence. And I know this on Veterans Day across the pond is of course similar. A lot is spoken about a child's resilience. What strategy as a parent do you employ with an older child who is clearly aware of that there's a war going on? Do Ukrainian parents find that they, distracting children whilst they're in the shelter, as we've heard on previous Tochny podcasts, and distracting them from the war as much as possible, it's a constant challenge that you find yourself facing?
Donald. First of all, I want to say that I have two children, and last year they live far away from me. We decided with my wife this way because I was very worried about their security, and they lived in Ukrainian city Chernivtsi. It's maybe 1,000 kilometers, not maybe, it's more than 1,000 kilometers from Dnipro. But this year, from September, we decided to live together because I say it's field more safety in Dnipro. And what about security children? Yeah. My older son is going goes to school, the second class, and they have shelter in school.
They sound like a great couple of kids with a fantastic father. Thank you, Basil.
Oh, thank you, Jonathan. I think it's
Will, welcome up to the panel. It's a privilege to have you up here.
No, thank you so much. And I hope that I can just add just a little bit of gravity to this as someone who's not from Ukraine and not from this, is that how important it is to understand that everybody is affected, right? My heart breaks. I've got a how do I, sorry, I just want to make, I, this is what I know it's going to talk about. So I want to make sure I get this right. I have a 3.5-year-old daughter, almost four. When I fought my wars, and I'm not trying to talk about myself, I'm going to try and use this as a way to explain situation or greater. I never had to defend my hometown. I never had to worry about my daughter being mortared or shelled or anything like that while I was on the front. I was in a war zone far, far away. And my first jog in Ukraine in the morning, I saw a little kid's room in a basement room. It was a basement room, basement apartment. And you could tell it was a little kid's room because you could look through it. But they had sandbags piled up halfway up the window in this kid's room. I don't know how to explain that. I don't know how to explain when I talk about my friends who had to clear their parents' property in counteroffensives. So Ukrainians spend their days a little bit different than ours. And it's just important to remember that it's not just the people on the front line, but it's every single Ukrainian that are in this fight. I mean, one of the things I hear a lot about is people saying that, you know, why aren't you fighting on the front line? Why aren't you? I've spent time with a lot of Ukrainians who are doing great things with spreadsheets and PowerPoints and things like that that are doing just as much good. But the devastating effect on the community and the families and the kids is just something that we can never, ever understand fully. But just that one image I want to think about. I want to think about if you are a parent and you have to think about, I need to fill sandbags to put in front of the window of my kid's room to save my kid's life. Because I don't know when, you know, a random rocket's going to come in and destroy me. So I just wanted to say that I brought that up. It just something hit me while I was listening. Thanks again. And Slava Ukraini. And thanks for everybody who's listening. Please retweet and share this space because this is a place where you get really good information about Ukraine. Glad to be up here and looking forward to the conversation.
Get out, Slava.
Thank you, Will. Vasyl, could you give us an idea of the types of solidarity that you've seen amongst the citizens of Dnipro during this war? People don't function solely on an individual level. They are members of a community. Could you give people who are not in Ukraine an idea of the community that exists in your part of Ukraine?
Yeah, Jonathan. Thanks for the question. First of all, I want to admit that the absolutely solidarity was first month of full invasion. It was totally solidarity. After that, solidarity is still here and we still work together. Still, people helping other people. My firm help people pro bono, which need this help. We also continue helping our warriors with additional questions. Even now, in very different cases, if you will be interested, I can tell about some stories. But I think it's not now. And solidarity is seen quite enough till now. People try to help each other. People understand that such situation, war, have to be closer to each other and be more politely help people which need more than some people as we can help. And that is why we have to. But first of all, there are many volunteers and organization. There are many people who collect money, not only money, who make a very big contribution to our soldiers. And we also help them.
I think that's evident, Vasyl, in the posts that we've seen from yourself and many other Ukrainians. That solidarity, it exists and it serves as a form of inspiration to people such as across the free world that individuals exist in communities. Thank you very much indeed. On the topic of solidarity, Bernardo, who was just returned from Ukraine, please go ahead.
Yeah, solidarity. I mean, this was a big factor, right? When people ask me in Ukraine, like, why I'm here, what I'm doing, and like, they wanted like, oh, what you're doing here, you should be some... No, they were like happy that people from Europe were coming, people from foreigners were coming into Ukraine, and like just by being there showing solidarity, right? And the other thing is like the unit I support who have like a personal connection of our friends to, it was a huge moral boost for them to know, like, oh, that's actually a guy from Germany supporting us. It's a guy, it's people from all over the world donating for this fundraiser and like supporting us to win the fight. This solidarity is really important as far as I experienced it, and people are really happy about it. So solidarity, empathy, that are the things which are like really helping people to cope with all the stress, and so that they feel not alone, because this was what people taught me, right? Someone from Europe here, it's not just like us here in the air raid alert again. We are not alone. People understand what's happening. People going home and telling people, hey, this is really happening.
Yeah, Bernard, it's really inspiring. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Will, please go ahead.
Now, to talk about global solidarity, and Bianata, it's so great to hear you and love seeing what you're doing over there. It was great to see some of the other folks. Artois, when I was in Ukraine a few weeks ago, and folks from Tachi being on the ground. And for folks who don't know, we've started to work to create a program to work with Ukrainian veterans. And one of our biggest things was to go over and, before anything else, was meet with Ukrainian veterans and not just be someone to come over there and tell them what to do. And we had to sit down and look at minimum viability. Every person part of the program that we're running is either volunteers or a few now full paid staff. But we had to look and say, is this worthwhile? And what I really realized from the get-go is just showing up, deciding that we're going to go from basic support to support, fundraising, to being boots on the ground to go talk to Ukrainians. And the impact that made was just incredible. And I recommend more people do that in an organized way, if that makes sense.
Thanks, Will. Whilst you're up here, I've got to ask you, on the 6th of August, you brought the Ukrainian Veterans Foundation lead and Natalia Kalmykova up, former Veterans Affairs leader, female leader, now Deputy Defense Minister. What does this mean to you and those within the veterans community that you work with to see her promoted to her current post?
So for folks that don't know, you can look back at the Tachini files and look at a couple weeks ago we had, or about a month ago, I'd say, we had a special with a really good friend of mine, Natalia, who led the Ukrainian Veterans Foundation. And she was one of the spearheads of the inspiration that created this national, this global group that's working to build Ukrainian Veterans Affairs from kind of the grassroots up. In the meantime, just a few days ago, there was an announcement that she was part of a new group of, she was just appointed to be the one of the deputy ministers of Veterans Affairs. And when I was in Ukraine, I think that we're 3-4 weeks behind news in general when it comes to Ukraine. I think overall, even though as well informed we are, but I got to see some of the transformation that they were doing in the Ministry of Department, the Defense, Ministry of Veterans Affairs, etc. But this is something that makes a lot of sense. This is someone who only cares about Ukraine. She was part of the Ministry of Defense before this. She was a doctor before that. Once the war started, she decided to find her calling. She worked in corporate, medical stuff, and she decided to use her skills as a organizer, as a manager, as a professional to support her country. And this is a story of thousands of people, like my friend Olga, who is the director of the Kyiv Fashion Week, one of the biggest fashion weeks in Europe. And he never used a gun in his life, and after the invasion he decided to pick up his arms, and now he's a lieutenant leading a sniper team. But Natalia, just taking over this position at this time, I think it's an incredibly good situation for the people she'd made connections with in America, in the global community, but also for Ukraine, because she's the future, like many other people, the future of Ukraine, people who are not willing to sidestep their morals, and they're willing to do everything they can, willing to take a Greyhound bus across America because they didn't have the funding to go talk to veteran organizations. She's a warrior, and I think all of us are lucky to have some sort of a contact with her, and she's going to do great things for her country. And one of the things that she'll be focused on, I'm sure, is making sure that when soldiers leave the military, is how do they be taken care of? So I just wanted to say it's massive congratulations to her. I think it'll be a few weeks before we can get her back on. I think she's got a whole bunch of learning to do, but I will be making sure that we try to work to do that as soon as possible.
Thank you, Will. And of course, everybody at Tochni and our audience, of course, sends their best wishes to Natalia in her new position. Whilst I've got you here, Will, I was wondering if you could provide a little bit of additional context to the role of armored units within, when it comes to defending newly liberated ground. This is obviously, as we've seen and as CJ noted at the top of the hour, this is incredibly important to Ukraine retaining liberated ground. What is that role? Could you describe that to in layman's terms? If possible.
Definitely. I would say area standoff. So the idea of putting as much distance between you and the enemy as possible. So what having a strong armored component, especially a NATO, like NATO style vehicles with good optics, is the allower to create standoff. It's the ability to put a Bradley in an area that can traverse from the 1 o'clock zone on a clock. Say if you're looking at the direction and the very front of you is 12 o'clock. If you could put a Bradley that is looking from 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock, and then next door to that is a Bradley, you know, a few hundred yards down the road that's looking from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock, and et cetera, you have an ability to create a standoff distance because NATO armor has much better optics. So the idea is we've seen this war turn into a very infantry-based war. It's an assault-based war. It's about using artillery to suppress the enemy. And then it's not even so much the armored vehicles. It's the infantry that are really taking back ground because they're not that big of a target. Tanks, Bradleys are big targets. But then once that trench line is taken, once that 500 meters had been fought for 3 or 4 days, the ability to bring up your armor and push back the enemy's defensive lines, because if there is an enemy team out there, the optics are going to be able to see it. I think that's one of the incredibly important parts of armor in this type of fight right now. Sooner or later, right, having that armor there as the infantry piece breaks through one hedgerow at a time, sooner or later, you're going to find yourself in a place where you've got an open field that's not mined, that that is not completely controlled. You're going to find a place where, guess what? We're going to be able to eat up 2, 3, 4 kilometers around because we have mobile mechanized infantry and tanks that can not only survive a beating, but can like bring a lot of fight to the enemy and bring the mass of a fight that needs, it's about a mass of fight. So you need to be able to have infantry, you need to have fighters, you need to have tanks and Bradleys, different types of armor, if you're going to push out past trying to do a breakthrough. So for right now, the most important part right now is on the defensive role, in my opinion, which is Russians aren't going to be able to come close to these defensive lines. If you've got a Bradley, if we've got a Martyr or a CB-90, because of their optics, but also being able to push the enemy back a little bit. I hope that helped a little bit.
Yeah, it did, Will. Thank you. In terms of what moves forward, what role, I mean, we've seen obviously that Ukraine has been moving forward with portable air defense. How important, what kind of, could you give us an outline of what role this plays during the defense of liberated territory?
So, I think the idea, again, going back to it, is like the idea of wide area security. So if you're going to make a breakthrough, it's easy to make a breakthrough. It's easy to make, a breakthrough of a line that's maybe, 500 meters, a kilometer wide. You push through. We've seen Russia do this many times. But if you don't have area security after that, if you can't control the ground that you've taken over, that's why you don't try and do like a very small, you got to try and do as wide as possible. It's a big deal. So creating wide area security is incredibly important. And that means using every tool you can to push the enemy back. so that they can't counterattack. And I would say that's one of the key parts of this is how do you create wide area security after breakthroughs? After you and look, we're looking at breakthroughs. We're not looking at breakthroughs like the parallel lines in the Gulf War. We're looking at breakthroughs of people dying and hundreds of rounds of artillery being shelled to win back 500 meters of ground. This is a disgusting, vile fight that infantry soldiers are taking on the brunt. But the question is, once those infantry soldiers take back a trench line, how do you put as much material behind them, whether it's artillery in the rear, whether it's air defense, whether it's to make sure that there's not counter battery, whether it's counter battery radio, like to bring into that space that they couldn't be in before because it was enemy territory, to then push the enemy back a little bit. That's the way I would explain it. It's not so much like how can air defense help one certain area, but if you can take back a piece of land and then control that land and make sure the enemy can't fight back, that's the most important thing, is pushing things forward.
I appreciate it, Will. Thank you. Without going into the specifics of how this is countered, it's obviously there is a lot of the role of drones in this war has evolved, and observation of each side is happening. Could you give anyone on the panel who wants to contribute, please feel free. What is the role of drones in defending territory? How are they best employed? And what advantage in terms of observation of the enemy do they provide to those defending forces and those looking to advance?
So I'll take the start of this and let everyone else jump in there. But this is something where I'm going to have to give credit to the Russians, actually, unfortunately, on this. I got to spend some time at the one zone. So it's building a layer of defense that's far back. And what I couldn't keep explaining was they kept talking about how good the Russian defensive lines are. And in retrospect, when we look at Dragon T's, when we look at like the tank traps, we look at the minefields, are very rudimentary things. But when you add in the ability to have good overview through drones, when you have a set of Dragon T's, even though they can get through, they're going to slow down the enemy, or they're going to slow down your forces. So the fact that you have drones being able to look over a defensive area, whether it's a drone, whether it's a balloon that's up in the air that has high resolution cameras on it, etc. If you can see the enemy coming, and unfortunately this terrain is full out war. It's hard with today's technology to hide any type of movement on the front with big units. So if there's a drone that can see, oh, by the way, this group's about to get to this Dragon Teeth, we know they're going to slow down. Let's start plotting the courses for that, you know, that section of the Dragon Teeth to drop artillery. That's what's slowing this counteroffensive a lot. So the idea of drone warfare, the idea of the defensive capability of just the observation part of it. And then you include your very, very well designed FPV drones, the drones that drop ordnances, etc., like tactical drones. Ukrainians are using them a lot when it comes to defending their lines, where they're able to reach out and touch units as they see them coming very early on before they get to the contact zone. So drones have just, I spent 3 days looking up at the sky more than I ever have in my life in an area in the east, because I was terrified. And the most terrified I was at when I was in Ukraine was when I saw a drone out of a window that was behind us. But the best thing in the world was my guys with me just laughed at me because it was one of their drones. It's a completely different situation than any American have ever fought when it comes to war on a full scale.
That dark humor you speak of, Will, I can't help but think of Sean Pinner, his recent book that's just been released this week, and I personally recommend. Sean Pinner, for those of you who don't know, was a British soldier fighting for the Ukrainian Marines, was captured in Mariupol. The way he describes traumatic events in his book, it is with dark humor, and it's easy for me to say, but the people who captured him were the in-betweeners, a group of teenagers. He was then transferred to a guy that looks like Ricky Gervais. I think that what you just described resonates even with people like myself. So yeah, thank you for adding that. All right. Thank you very much for everyone on the panel today. We're very lucky to be joined by Ben, who has been building a defensive wall of it by using his economics books. But apart from that, I'm joking, of course. Ben, you're able to talk about, I believe, the Russian economy in terms of how it's reacting currently to this war. Is there a chance? Is it getting boosted? Is it going in the opposite direction?
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Always a gentleman. And hello to everyone, both on the panel and listening. Well, happy Sunday. I hope it's happy for you, because for me, the week was a bit difficult for many reasons, but one of them was related to the war and to the fact that I was getting worried. I was hearing a lot of very positive things about the Russian economy. Yes, I'm the first one to say, don't listen to this. But at the end of the day, earlier in the conflict, you could only hear bad things about it. And now you are starting to hear good things about it. And one thing was kept coming back. It was the idea of military Keynesianism. I should have practiced. Jonathan, you're a native speaker. Can you tell me how to say Keynesianism? You know, the Keynes stuff.
Keynesianism? I don't have the word for it in the moment.
All right. So Keynesianism. All right. So Keynesianism it is. So they're talking about military Keynesianism again and again and again, to the point of having me really worried, because the idea is very simple. What the Russian economy, what can happen to the Russian economy is the state is going to pour so much money in, it's going to be so boosted that just on that push alone, it's going to be able to, you know, carry it through the next decade or something, and that the Russian economy is going to grow and grow and keep growing. And despite all the efforts of both the international community and above anything else, Ukraine, Russia is going to grow and is going to be bigger. And while today Ukraine only has to contend with one Russia, if things go like this, they might end up in 5 years' time having to contend with 1.2 Russias or 1.3 Russias, you know, bigger. So I was worried. And that's when a great guy on the internet, his name is Nick Berman Trinket, came up. And she told me a lot of interesting things. If you have a chance to follow him, you should absolutely. He's very smart, but he's a lot smarter than me. And he's really, really cool. So have a look. I've posted one of his latest tweets on the Nest. And he made me see the light. So I'd like to summarize with you the conversation I had with him. And it started with, what is the baseline? What are we looking at? And the first thing we need to realize is the fact that if the invasion of Ukraine may appear like such a boost for the Russian economy, it's because the Russian economy has been driven into the ground by Putin and his team over the past decade or so. A little bit more. 2008, 2011, that's the moment when the Russian economy crashes and never quite recovers. Just a very quick number. The Russian economy today is the size of the Russian economy 13 years ago, which means in comparison with the United States, that has grown 26%. That's an interesting number to keep in mind. So is the war the best thing that has happened to Russia, and why? Well, because during the past 10 years or so, three things were dominating the macroeconomic policy of the Putin government. Sorry for using big words, but these are really important to keep in mind. The first one was to save like squirrels and put all their money into the NWF, the National Wealth Fund. They were saving. The thing grew so fast, they actually reached the limit that they had set themselves for. they were planning to fill the fund in 12 years. They filled it in 3. They were squirreling like mad. The second thing they were doing was to keep extremely high interest rates, really, really high. We're talking 7% at the time when the West was tickling the minus 1%. So they were extremely, extremely high rates of interest, easily 10 times higher than in many Western countries. And this, again, had a really limiting effect on the Russian economy. And the final one is the fact that the Russian were allowing a lot of private capital to leave Russia, mostly to go to Cyprus and then spread around the world. But this was encouraged, at the very least, not not forbidden. And all this made it very difficult for Russia to grow and meant that Russia was basically infertile and sterilized as an economy, simply could not grow. And that's when February 24th, 2022 arrived. The playing field changed so fast and so much that everything I just told you came in reverse. The interest rates were first hiked extremely high, but then lowered, especially considered to the Western interest rate that, on the other hand, were increased. And you found yourself in situations where now, whereas it had been easily 10% higher, now the interest rates in Russia were sometimes as little as 3 or even 2% higher, two times higher than the interest rates in the West. National Wealth Fund was tapped. A lot of money was taken out and reinvested in the economy. And also, it was forbidden to take away too much capital from Russia. There was a capital fight, another story, but at the very least, there were limits put onto this. So all this sort of boosted the Russian economy. And, well, I'm supporting Ukraine, but I don't want to have to blind myself. If Russia is set to win economically and to get bigger, I need to realize this. I need to tell it to myself, and I need to spread the news for actions to be taken, hopefully. And that's when I got worried, honestly. And that's when Nick arrived. Because what Nick told me is, look at what you're saying. What is Keynesianism? If you think about it carefully, it is not replacing private spending by public spending. That is not what it is. Keynesianism is to introduce extra spending so that it creates a sort of positive environment in the economy that convinces people to restart the machine, to restart the factories, to start hiring again. The very point of Keynesianism is a shock therapy that will allow the economy to tap again into the dormant resources. And the most important of those dormant resources is unemployed people. Basically, the idea is that in an economy in crisis, you've got 10, 15, 30% of the population that is unemployed. People are starting to get used to the new normal, and they're thinking, okay, well, doesn't matter. I cannot hire them, but the economy is still alive. We can continue like this. The point of Keynesianism is to get people to spend and to introduce the want of hiring more. And the fact that you're hiring more will lead to more hiring and more hiring, and you will decrease the amount of unemployment. You will decrease the amount of dormant resources. That's the idea of Keynesianism. And that's when Nick told me, look at what's going on in Russia at the moment. What dormant resources do they have? They have the highest rate of employment in their own history. There is no one to be hired in Russia. There is no factories that are laying dormant at the moment. There's no closed factory. They're using them. There's nothing that they can tap into. There's nowhere to grow. They simply cannot grow. And the very idea of military Keynesianism maybe could be applied in other cases, but in this particular case, is absolute nonsense. it's an absolute nonsense because it doesn't fit the present profile of Russia. This will not happen, and it's not even a prediction, it's a guarantee. Russia will not grow thanks to the extra oomph provided by the war. And it confirms what we all know and what we all think, with the fact that for Russia, invading Ukraine was the worst decision possible. And from the point of view of an economist, invading Ukraine was the worst economic decision Putin could ever have made. So I stopped dooming, I stopped being worried, I thanked Nick, and I understood that Russia was going for the wall and they were not going to grow, they were not going to become a juggernaut, unstoppable. They are much more likely to explode and to crash than they are to grow significantly in the coming few years. So that's good news for everyone. And on this day of the defenders, I would like to thank them from the bottom of my heart. And Slava Ukraine.
Heroin Slava. Rambunctious as ever, Ben. Thank you. And I've got an apology to make to you. It's actually... what do you think the apology is?
You stole my toothbrush.
Oh, it's pretty close. I gave you the wrong pronunciation. It's actually Keynesian. I was, let's just say, on the move when you asked me. An open back unrounded vowel, Keynesian. But thank you, Ben.
Jonathan, can I ask you, can I re-record the segment saying, pronouncing it properly then before we air it on the podcast? Because did you know we have a podcast?
Yes. I'm sure we can somehow copy and paste that into our Spotify, Apple, Google, and the plethora of other podcasts where, of course, you can find Tochny. Okay, on this day of the defenders, I'm going to ask Vessel, who's up on the panel, if he would like to give us any closing words. Vessel, the floor is yours, sir.
Oh, no, thanks for this. And what I want to say, first of all, I want to say Slava Ukraine, Slava Ukraini, and Slava нашим героям. In this Defenders Day, it's very important to support them. In Ukraine, we have one understanding, one maybe non-written rule, that when some of soldiers, some of units collect money for cars, for maybe drones, for another object, we say that not them need car, not soldiers need drone, that we Ukrainians need, and we have to buy, have to give money, and we understand that it's critical important for all us. And for you, I say that thank you that you spent your time about Ukraine. It's important too, because people need to know truth, and I think this Tochny podcast, it makes very critical and very important role in this way. Thank you, everyone. Be safe.
Same to you, Vessel. Thank you. And on that note, Ukraine's allies, everyone listening, we ask ourselves quite often, what can I do for Ukraine today? And in the words of President Zelensky, the 1st of October 2023, if I may quote him, being a defender means taking action every day. Behind us is our history. Ahead is our victory. It is important who we were. It is important who we have become and who we are now. It is important who we will become. Thank you for joining Tochny this week, everybody. Slava Ukraini.
Heroin Slava.
Slava.
Smash one.
Four of them.
On behalf of the brave.